is Stuart Allen speaking from Wilson Street Chapel, the Chapel of the Open Book, London. We continue our studies in Paul's first letter to his son in the faith, Timothy, chapter 1. And last time we were considering the tremendous emphasis in these pastoral letters of Paul on the word doctrine. And that's easily understood when we remember he's writing to two believers who were leaders, teachers, Timothy, Titus. Obviously, a leader who's going to teach must have something worthwhile to teach. He can be teaching truth, or alas, he can be teaching things which are not truth. Hence the importance of true doctrine. And all the word doctrine means is teaching. It's God's instruction to us. Now, I'm sure no one is going to say that this isn't important. God is telling us what he wants us to be, what he wants us to do, what he wants us to know about himself and his great plans. That is doctrine. How comes it that so many Christians say they're not interested in doctrine? That it's dry, that it's not interesting. Talk to them about doing something and they'll get quite excited, some of them. But say, no, let's have a good time of getting down to the word and see what the doctrine is that he wants us to learn. Well, friends, of course, the answer is there's a balance in this. We cannot be practical. We cannot do anything that's acceptable for the Lord until we know what he wants us to do. Knowing what he wants to be and do is doctrine, and the practice follows after doing it. And this is the balance that should be in my life and should be in yours. Now, to these leaders then, the importance of teaching for the people under their charge. And this is a very serious thing. For any teacher to teach wrong doctrine. We've seen in chapter 1 that he was to exhort, Timothy was, that they teach no other doctrine. Chapter 1 verse 3. There must be no swerving aside here. There must be no adding little bits to make it more palatable. Or bringing in the thoughts of the teacher or any of his predilection. This won't do. It must be solely and wholly God's truth. And a faithful teacher has to watch very carefully because the Lord is going to hold him responsible for teaching wrongly, no other doctrine. Now we go on then. In his instruction to Timothy, he says in verse 4, something else to avoid, Timothy. Do not give heed to myths, fables, and endless genealogies which minister questions. Just raises problems. Rather than godly edifying, which is in faith. Now, in our translation, godly edifying, we've got the truth somewhat veiled, which is a pity. Whereas what actually Paul wrote was a dispensation of God. We come to this important word dispensation again. Rather than a dispensation of God, which is in faith. What is the apostle warning Timothy about? Who are these people that go in for endless genealogies and myths, fables? Well, it may be a little bit difficult for us to put our finger, living so long after the time, as to what this involves. But noting what is said in the pastoral letters and knowing something of the times in which Paul and Timothy lived, we cannot go far wrong if we see in this false Jewish teachers. And note it revolves around the law and genealogies and so on. And we do know at this time that there were those amongst the Jews who were teaching falsely in this way. False Jewish teachers. We know for a fact that there was a Jewish book called the Jubilees, which was a computation of mythical histories based on the Old Testament. The Old Testament, with added all sorts of myths and legends, considered it to make it, I suppose, more palatable or more thrilling. I don't know why, but that's what they were doing. A compilation, then, of mythical histories based on the Old Testament. Now we find not only Paul warning Timothy of this, but if you turn to Titus, go a little further along, chapter 1, he tells Titus he has to point out that they have a very bad reputation, the Cretans. They're always liars, evil beasts, slow bellies, verse 12. This witness, says the apostle, is true. This is not an exaggeration. They're bad character people as a whole. Wherefore, rebuke them sharply, that they may be sound in the faith, not giving heed to Jewish, here it is, fables and myths, and commandments of men that turn from the truth. So evidently, this was something that wasn't just localized at Ephesus. Titus had to face the same problem in Crete. So one, I think, is certainly justified in thinking this was quite a common problem which these early Christians had to face. Or, let's look at 2 Timothy for a moment. In the second chapter, after giving us one of the great faithful sayings, in verse 11 of the pastoral letters, he said in verse 14, of these things put them in remembrance, charging them before the Lord, that they strive not about words to no profit. Striving, arguing about words, but to the upsetting, the subverting of the hearers. And then verse 15, which we know and love so well with its command to rightly divide the word of truth. Verse 16, but shun profane and empty babblings. Here's a similar thing. For they will increase, they will get worse, unto more ungodliness, and their word will eat as does a gangrene the margin. We're going to see that in a moment. There's something opposite to that. A healthy doctrine. Here's a doctrine or teaching that leads to the very opposite of being healthy, to canker, to gangrene. This, of course, is really Satan's counterfeit. Now, he's always, of course, been doing this. And I feel that he's to be feared most, not as the roaring lion going about seeking whom he may devour, but rather as the angel of light that makes what he's trying to put forward look like the real thing, look like the truth of God. This has always been, of course. And we've got to watch even today, because this enemy is still working. And this very letter is going to warn us about the last days, when there shall be deceiving spirits, doctrines, teachings. Now, here's the word doctrine again, look. But teachings of demons. Demons. Does this mean to say this is going to be awful sort of teaching? Vile teaching? Not necessarily. It's going to be teaching that looks quite attractive on the surface. The sort of thing that perhaps a Christian might fall for, would appeal to. Oh, but friends, we've been given something to compare. We've been given, as it were, God's gold, the reality, the truth in his word, that we can compare everything with. Aren't we thankful for that? If we hadn't, where should we be? We'd have nothing to measure things by. But we have. And what a precious thing this word of truth is. This was possibly what later developed into what is termed Gnosticism, which we have mentioned in these studies before. We don't want to be technical, but it will help us to get just a little idea, maybe, of what this early era was. This wasn't the developed thing that came in the second century, but it was something that started. You've only got to read the Colossian letter to find Paul already had to correct something at Colossae that was going wrong, the worshipping of angels, and a kind of a false holiness, and so on. You see, Satan never gives up. I was reading just recently someone who was trying to combat the idea that Satan was working in the early centuries. Very strange, isn't it? As much to say, he didn't start any opposition until about century 3. My goodness. This person certainly was very wide of the mark. He's never finished, Rand. He never stops. There's always this great deceiver, that's what the Bible calls him, a liar and a deceiver, working so as, if possible, to make what Paul is going to warn Timothy, that those that have turned aside, to swerve, to go off the lines, as we say. That's what he wants to do. And let us, none of us think that we are beyond going off the lines. We're either too Christian or too clever. We've all got that tendency, unless we're guarded by this great deposit of truth. Now, this is something what they taught. I want to just mention this to you, because it'll help us to understand what Timothy had to combat, and Titus. They taught that God was called bythos, the Greek for death, and by acting upon his own mind, produced two other beings of different sexes, which were called aeons, ages. Now, the Bible talks about ages. Oh, yes. Ephesians talks about the purpose of the ages, God's purpose. Satan talks about ages, aeons, or emanations. And from these two, from successive descents, there sprang a series of other ages, all the lots of them, coming down from God, right down lower and lower and lower and lower, until they got right down to humanity. When anyone attempted to trace out this celestial pedigree, genealogy, you see, there arose great arguments as to how many ages there were, and in what sort of order they went, which went after which. Now this is what Paul is telling Timothy to watch, endless genealogies. This was, friends, a false purpose of the ages, and not only that, but they taught that these ages that came between God and humanity were a kind of a mediatorial list of beings that separated a very holy God from sinful humanity. Of course, they were right in saying that God is a very holy God. He most certainly is. And they taught that all matter was evil. So, of course, God couldn't have any direct contact with humanity. He had to have... Now, what does 1 Timothy say? There's one go-between. It's quite right, there's got to be a mediator between holy God and sinful men. But only one. They taught there had to be lots. This was the satanic false mediation that the early centuries were beginning to absorb. So you had a false purpose of the ages, and you had false mediators. And both these things are combated in this first letter. I think when we know that, it helps us to understand a little bit more why Paul is stressing to Timothy that he must be on the watch as a leader and see that these things are not spreading. He has to make a stand, a faithful stand for the truth. Now, what's the opposite? A dispensation of God, godly edifying, which is in faith, a dispensation of God. Well, now, here we come to this great word that we have, of course, been so much helped by, the word dispensation. Now, what is a dispensation? I'm going to assume now that we don't know all there is to know about it, but we want to learn. I would like to say to begin with that it's not what some people say it is, the same as the word age. I find so many Christians talk about dispensations and ages as though they're one and the same thing. As though a dispensation is a period of time. It is not. Both words are scriptural. Ages are in the Bible and in the New Testament. The word dispensation is in the New Testament. And in a very good place to look it up, although you won't find it translated there, is in the well-known parable that the Lord gave of the unjust steward. The steward who twisted. The steward who wasn't faithful. And the master said, give an account of your dispensation. That's what the Greek says. Your stewardship. That's the meaning of the word dispensation. A stewardship. Nothing to do primarily with time at all. Only in the sense that a stewardship that's been given to somebody has a beginning and it may have an end. Oh yes, I'll agree. The word time comes into it then. But it's not the same as a period of time. And please don't use it like that. Don't talk about the seven dispensations when you really mean seven ages. Or periods of time. This is a stewardship. What about the stewardship? It's something that's been committed, given to somebody to take charge of. Something that you don't possess. Something that somebody's put into your hands to look after. A bailiff, if you like, put in charge of someone's property. A steward. Now, this is exactly what the Apostle Paul said. That's exactly what I am. It's not Paul's truth. It's the Lord's truth, but he has deposited it, committed it to me. And now I'm finishing, Timothy, and it's going to be deposited to you. You'll be God's steward. And then in the last letter, you see in your turn that you deposit it, commit it to faithful men. Because you see, when you're handling somebody else's property, you can't be fast and loose with it. It's not yours to do what you like with. You've got to give an account. Well, I do feel, friends, that if only Christians, if only we, myself, and all who are listening to me, could keep this well in mind, what a safeguard this would be to us, wouldn't it? We have nothing in the way of originating truth. I only have what God's given me in his book. He opens my eyes to see it, to appreciate its wonder, and then he says, no wonder I'm going to ask you what you've done with it. Because we must all, says the word, stand before the judgment seat of Christ and give an account. Oh yeah, that's right, isn't it? He's the Lord, he's the master, it's his truth. What more natural that he should say then, well, what did you do with my truth in that earthly life of yours, when you professed to serve me? Now all are going to be in two classes. They can only be in two classes. Either they've been absolutely loyal, faithful, or disloyal. Unfaithful. Faithful or unfaithful. I don't find the Bible makes any medium or middle course, partly faithful and partly unfaithful, although that may be true. It says either faithful or unfaithful. Now let's go back for a moment to 1 Corinthians. Chapter 4. Let a man so account of us, and Paul is speaking of himself, of course, although he uses the plural, the editorial we, as of the servants, the ministers of Christ, and stewards of the mysteries, the secrets of God. Now then, this is the point, says Paul. Moreover, it is required in stewards that a man be found faithful, loyal, trustworthy. That's the meaning of this word. One that you can trust. Now surely there's no need for me to stress this or to try and tell anybody what it means. It's only too obvious what it means. In the normal course of events, none of us would be so silly as to give anything we value to someone that we can't trust. We would only hand something that we value to people that we can trust. Friends, this is the acid test. I wish Christians could get this clear, and I do pray the Lord will ever keep it before my mind as well. Which does the Lord want most, quantity or quality? Well, first of all, quality. And then quantity, if necessary, after. But never turn it round the other way about. Never say, how much have I done? First of all, what sort of quality has been my work? Is it something that he can approve of? Can he say I've been absolutely loyal to him? Can I say, like Paul said on one occasion, I have kept nothing back, he said to the Ephesian church. I have declared all the counsel of God. I have kept back nothing. Now that's a mark of faithfulness. I haven't kept back anything. I haven't twisted it. I haven't altered it. I've given you everything that the Lord's given me. Now friends, if you can say that, if I can say that, at the end of our lives, we're going to be happy people. But you see, we're deciding that every day of our lives now. It's no good to wait till we get there and suddenly wake up to the fact, well, I wonder if I've been faithful or not. This should be our concern. Day by day. Now Paul is bringing this home to this young fellow as a leader. It's a stewardship of God, he says. That's the thing. It's God's truth. You are his steward. And therefore, you have got to watch it, Timothy. You've got to guard things very carefully, knowing that one day the Lord is going to ask you to give an account. So there's two ways. You can either go off and swerve aside. He's going to use the word in a minute. Look at verse 6, 1 Timothy 1. Which some having swerved, here it is. Some having swerved have turned aside. One means to miss the mark, and the other is to go right off the course. And we know how the apostle is using, of course, this conception of running a race, keeping on the track. That's what a runner has to do, doesn't he? Keep on the track if he's going to get to the golden breath to take. Well, he said some haven't done that. And why they haven't done it is because they've been swerved aside with Satan's counterfeit truth. The angel of light teaching. A dispensation, a stewardship of God, verse 4, then, which is in faith. Trust. Now he says, the end of the commandment is charity. Let's put it a little clearer. Not the end in the point of time. The Greek says the goal of the charge, because we've seen this is one of the characteristic words of 1 Timothy. Paul was giving this boy a charge. And that is what's done today. When a minister starts his ministry at a church, he's usually given a charge. Very good thing too. Would to God they all kept it, if the charge is really worthy. And Paul is certainly giving this boy a charge. But he says, what's the goal of it? The goal of the charge is love. That's the goal. Out of a pure heart and a good conscience. See, love arises from a threefold source. A pure heart, a good conscience, and non-hypocritical, that's what the Greek says, faith. Unfeigned faith. Note the way he links these together in this letter. Verse 19. Holding faith and a good conscience. There they are again. Which some having put away concerning faith have made shipwreck. Chapter 3 and verse 9. Holding the mystery of the faith in a pure conscience. And then in the second letter to Timothy, chapter 1. And verse 3, I thank God, whom I serve from my forefathers with pure conscience. So the apostle has quite a lot about conscience. Pure heart, a pure conscience. Didn't the Lord say, blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God? What does it mean? Well, the heart, of course, speaks for the mind. It means pure thinking, pure motives, in other words. But you say to me, can anybody do Christian service without that? Well, apparently they can. It seems extraordinary that motives can be wrong in Christian service, but you know, friends, they can. Oh, yes. Why are we doing certain things? If we're really honest with ourselves, why are we doing certain Christian work? Is it to appear good in the sight of other people? Is it to please somebody? Is it to make, well, the Bible says, a fair show in the flesh? You can do that in Christian things, friends. To make a show. All these things, the motives are absolutely wrong. And no matter how good the works are, God will never accept them. They're what the Bible calls dead works. Got no life in them at all. It's only living works. Honest. Good. Faithful service that the Lord is going to recognize. So a pure heart starts off, and a good conscience. Now conscience, you know, is one of those things really that can't function properly by itself. You know, it's something like faith. We've had to point this out on more than one occasion, that faith can't exist by itself either. You just can't have faith like that, without relation to somebody or something. You can't just say, I believe. It doesn't mean anything, it doesn't make sense. What do you believe, you have to say, you see? You must say, I believe this, or I believe that person. Then you've got a complete statement. Now, conscience is very much like that. Conscience cannot exist apart from resting on something. And we've got to be very careful about this, you know. Some people have what's called a morbid conscience. Conscience is pushing them and jogging them and... But if it's not resting on the right thing, it's no help at all. What's it got to rest on? It's got to rest on God's truth. Of course it has, just like faith. Faith rests on God's truth. Faith comes by hearing, and hearing by the word. of God. Conscience is just the same thing. I get to know God's truth in my heart and mind. If I've got that pure motive, I want to know it, and I've just got his glory in my heart and mind, then conscience will come along and keep reminding me, keeping me on the track, you see. If I start to swerve, conscience will say, look, 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 it is written. Now, you see, conscience has got something to act on. Friends, it must. If you shut the book up and expect conscience to act, it won't. It won't. It'll just, well, if it does act, it'll simply lead you wrong. Furthermore, this very letter warns us in chapter 4 about those in the very opposite. Verse 2, speaking lies in hypocrisy, having their conscience burned, seared with a hot iron. Is there such a thing as a seared conscience? Yes. Is there such a thing as a quenched conscience? Yes. Is conscience something that will happen no matter what I do? Or whatever my behaviour is, or however I live? No, it doesn't. I can keep saying no to conscience until the thing has been quenched so long it doesn't act anymore. If the word says it's seared, it's burnt, finished. Now that's a terrible thing. Because conscience is given us as something which the Holy Spirit can work on, as I say, to keep us right on the dot, if I must use the expression. Right on the point of truth. Now, Timothy, then, this is what you've got to have. You've got to have pure motives, a pure heart, and a good conscience, not a bad one, a good conscience, and faith that's not put on, no pretense about it. No pretense. It's got to be real. It's got to be genuine, in other words. A faith unfeigned. Now, Timothy, if it isn't like this, you see what's going to happen? You're going to be amongst those which you haven't got it, have swerved and turned aside. The things these things can lead to, you see how important they are? It's not merely just saying, well, I'll give myself a little self-examination, I'm not so bad after all. No, we've got to be serious about this. Because the consequences are very serious indeed. We can be switched off the track, swerved, turned aside to just an empty noise, vain jangling. That's what God says about it. No matter how much it may appear in front of other people as being very good Christian service, God says just an empty noise. Nothing in it, no value whatsoever. Desiring to be teachers of the law, understanding neither what they say or wherein they affirm. Some evidently trying to be rabbis, trying to be teachers, and they weren't appointed or called by God. These are these Jewish people who were trying to lead away, Satan was using to try and lead the early Christians away from the faith. Well, now, I see my time is gone, but have to stop at this point. Let us, shall we, ask the Lord to keep our motives absolutely pure. Let us be kept absolutely loyal to the truth committed, so that we do not, in any sense of the word, ever forsake the track of truth, the real road that is finally going to lead us to glory, to be with the Saviour. And in that day then, we can meet him unashamed. We can look him straight in the face, not with shame. For these very letters are going to tell us that it's possible to meet him with shame, but all to be an unashamed workman. See, workman. A service, one who's done something for the Lord, unashamed, rightly dividing the word of truth.